The hour of 10:15 having arrived, we will call the House Tax Committee to order. I would like to welcome everyone. If Representative Agbaje, could you please move the minutes from March 4th, 2026?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Are there any additions or corrections? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Agbaje. Okay, just an announcement, and I don't know if this is legal. But the Senate Tax Committee, I knew that'd get your attention. The Senate Tax Committee just passed the PTE bill 9-0 to the floor of the Senate. So that's just for informational purposes. I think in House rules you cannot mention the other body or the governor's office. So
unless it's negative.
If that was inappropriate, that's fine. Okay, so with that being said, let's move on to, we have a presentation from the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota Inter-County Association. So we've got Matt Hilgert, Nathan Jessen, that'll start us out. Well, okay, and who do we have in the middle there? Who are you?
Kathleen Walls with Dakota County.
Oh, Dakota County. Okay. Okay, we welcome the three of you, but to get started here, a good friend of mine was watching the some tapes from the Omnibus Tax Bill in 2015. And my dear friend, and I mean that sincerely, Diane Loeffler, we were very good friends, was commenting on the Omnibus Tax Bill about how the counties are still using black and green screens. So I'm sure we might hear some of that today. I hope we do. Okay. Okay, so with that being said, who would like to start out? Mr. Jessen, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nathan Jessen. I represent the Minnesota Inter-County Association. MICA, the easiest way to think of us is we're 17 of the 87 counties, basically the biggest counties that aren't Hennepin and Ramsey. Am I good to get started here?
Please proceed.
Just want to... Mr. Hilgert and I are here to talk today about some property tax trends, not just property taxes and kind of the historical look and the moment we are in 2026, but also what's driving increases, particularly at the county level, what's causing some of those increases, and trying to take a deeper dive on some of those issues. So the reality is that counties are facing budget pressures on all fronts right now. And it's one thing that's important to remember when it comes to the work of county government. Most of what we do is making sure that state and federal mandates are followed through at the local level. It's not always the most glamorous work, but it's essential and it's mandated from the state and federal government. I'm going to throw some numbers at you, but a few examples from MICA counties in Washington County. 69% of the county budget is for following state and federal mandates. In Dakota County, it's 70%. In Crow Wing County, it's 83%. So that just kind of gives you an idea of the work of counties generally. Mr. Hilgert's going to talk a little bit more about the H.R. 1 bill that passed federally last July. It's important to remember that those federal cost shifts are also coming on top of state cost shifts that passed in 2025. I've got state budget pressures here. There's $61 million in HHS cost shifts that passed in 2025 for fiscal 28-29, with another $90 million that are possible depending on future legislative action. And I hate to sound like a broken record when I'm talking about shifts, but it happens a lot. Those state and federal shifts are on top of the shifts that became law back in 2011 to balance the budget at that time when counties faced budget shifts from the state, asking them to pick up increased parts, increased costs, and those shifts were never repealed in the interim since 2011. So how are all those mandates paid for? Well, if you're talking about the county level, it's from county property taxes. I've got own source county revenue. If you're curious, this is OSA, Office State Auditor budget data here. 85% of the county's own source revenue, so the revenue that they're raising at their level, not state or federal funds, is from the property tax. That's the general fund revenue source that we have. 13% is for other taxes. That's largely local sales taxes that are dedicated to specific projects, like county transportation projects, and in some cases, specific facilities, if the The county has a local sales tax authorization for that, which are just granted by the legislature. And that's a strong contrast to the state, right? I've got the, this is MMB data at the bottom here. But the state has a much larger tool shed of options when it comes to raising revenue. If we're talking about raising revenue at the county level, and this is just true for local governments broadly in Minnesota, we're talking about property taxes. And I do think it's important to mention that the property tax is really the most visible tax. You don't get a letter from the state each year saying, here's how much you paid in sales taxes last year, right? You do get a letter from the county saying, like, here's what your property taxes were last year. Here's what they're going to be this upcoming year. Here's how your values are shifted. If you're talking about how visible a tax is, property tax really takes the cake in that regard. And there's also a robust process that local governments go through to involve local taxpayers when it comes to making their budgets. I think it was in the late 80s that the truth in taxation process went into law, and that includes both the notices and the hearings that the counties and cities also go through. And, you know, you all talk a lot about how progressive or regressive is a tax. It's true that the property tax isn't the most regressive tax, but it is the one that's least tied to the ability to pay. You know, sales taxes are more regressive, but it's based on what you're already paying for something. The property tax, it's based on your value rather than your receipt, is, I guess, an easy way to think about it. So what happened with property taxes in 2026? Why are we talking about this? I've got a neat little map here that shows this is final levy data. I think DOR released this just last week. But kind of looking at the levy changes for 2026 statewide. And I think what this data shows is that this is really the budget pressures that we're talking about. Whether you're metro or non-metro, they're affecting you. You can see non-metro counties, 7% average increase, seven-county metro, 8.2% average increase. That 7.6% average increase is the largest countywide increase in the last 25 years. We had that with some counties having record-high levies for them for their own county while they were also looking at cuts and making cuts on the non-mandated side. It's because, I mean, counties are always going to be responsive to their local taxpayers, and there's only so much that a county can put on its levy. But obviously in 2026, with the mandates that have been coming down, those numbers increased. I did just want to show you kind of a historical view of property taxes. These are these same average statewide numbers, but kind of historically over the last, going back to 2003, so post big plan for those of you that were around in 2001 when Jesse Ventura worked with the legislature on that property tax reform. I think that was probably just you, Mr. Chair.
Was that an old joke?
It's a seniority joke. It's not an age joke.
Much good recovery. Good job.
So just so you know, other local levies here, that's your cities, your school districts, your special taxing districts, your townships. I think it's important to look at this to kind of give you a historical sense of where we are. So I noted earlier that the county level increase is the highest it's been in the last 25 years. You can see that there. During the 2000s, it was a time of really budget uncertainty when it came to state aids to local governments. So property taxes were a little bit higher at that time. They dipped in the following years, largely due to a recession, right? Values stagnated. It was, counties, local governments, again, are going to be responsive to their local taxpayers. And, you know, it's in 2012 and 2013, you see those are some of the lowest years. It's not like, oh, did we have levy limits in at that time? The answer is no, we did not. It was just a matter of local governments being responsive to what they saw the needs were at the local level. Since that time, levies had been relatively stable. You can see a big dip in 2021. That's due to kind of an influx of federal aid, especially at that moment in time. But levies have been kind of climbing a little bit since that time, and that brings us to 2026. I know that I haven't talked about shifts enough yet, so I want to talk about another kind of shift, and that's the value shift that can happen. So obviously, over the last 10 years or so, we've seen residential homestead property in particular, values have risen significantly. You can see the big spike in 2023, and it's important to remember when homesteads experience that spike, that's not just a one-time spike in your value. It's built into your value the next year. If your value goes up 20% 1 year and 2% the next year, it's not just a 2% increase, it's 22% over those 2 years. So that value change is really being felt, and what I would say is that when property taxes are going up more, after about a decade of value shifting, generally speaking, to residential homesteads in particular, residential homesteads are going to feel those spikes more than they would have if a similar increase in property taxes had happened 10 years ago. So that's another issue that we're dealing with. I have commercial value on here just because it's the second most common property type when you're looking at property value statewide. There's been a lot of coverage of why commercial value is more stagnant, particularly if you're talking about downtowns. But this isn't the result of policy decisions that you all are making. It's just a result of value shifts. And I'm happy to take questions as we go along, or you all, Mr. Chair, I defer to you.
Why don't you finish up, then we'll go to questions.
Okay. So that's just something that I think we really need to bear in mind. The other thing is that you all will inevitably hear some bills that come forward that propose property tax shifts for maybe it's one or a certain kind of property. And on your revenue estimate, you're going to see not a general fund cost but a property tax refund interaction, because if we provide a property tax benefit to one class of property, well, it's not just that their taxes go down, it's that other people's taxes go up. And where it comes through on the state general fund is just property tax refunds get more expensive. But at the local level, those shifts are felt even more strongly with the reduction of tax base. So there's a number of tools that the legislature has used historically to address property taxes. One that has been in place since 2012 is what's called the homestead market value exclusion. At a really simple level, generally speaking, about $38,000 of either your residential or ag homestead, your house, garage, and 1 acre, are excluded from your value. That's under current law. But practically speaking, when values increase so much, that $38,000 is static. So a lower percentage of your value, of homestead value, is being excluded than it used to be. And you can see that in the chart here. Obviously, there's a jump in 2025. That's a result of a 2023 law change that increased the homestead market value exclusion from about $30,000 to $38,000. That was in recognition of this. But even that level just brought us back to essentially 2022 levels due to the high level of inflation and residential value increases that have happened since 2022. This is another shift, to be clear, but it is the only one that kind of broadly benefits residential homesteads and the house, garage, and 1 acre of agricultural property. The other thing I want to talk about a little bit is county program aid. So this kind of just shows you how county program aid compares to the levies at county level, as well as county program aid compared to the overall state general fund budget. As you can see quite clearly, county program aid is a less significant portion of local government budgets than it used to be. And that's significant for the conversation that we're having here today, because when costs go up, when mandates go up, more and more is falling on the property tax, which is the one state, the one general fund revenue source that counties have, than on state aid. Whereas, 25 years ago, you can see that comparatively, county program aid probably would have been picking up a larger share of those costs. And, you know, the state budget situation is what it is. I think counties are especially understanding of that. We have to balance budgets every year and understand that as well as anyone. But the state budget situation being what it is, we're not predicting that these trends are going to, you know, immediately turn around here. But it is something to bear in mind when you're hearing from your constituents about property taxes. With that, I would turn it over to Mr. Hilgard.
And before we do that, Chair Swedzinski.
Thank you, Chair Davids. And to the testifier, just kind of want to kind of dive in just a bit. You touched on the commercial real estate and kind of how that dynamic is really changing. We saw the Ameriprise building sell last year. It was at one time valued at over $200 million, sold for, I believe, $6 million. We saw the lumber building in Minneapolis, kind of a large office space, a very historical building that was once valued at, I think, $36 million, now sold for a dollar. You know, what kind of trend do you see continuing when it comes to kind of downtown areas and, you know, from a valuation standpoint? And, you know, obviously those services all cost. And so when you have, you know, Target, you know, essentially cutting their lease, $100 million in penalties to get out of some commercial real estate, what's that going to do from a county perspective, city perspective, from your group's thing? So how fast do you think that change will happen?
Mr. Jessen.
Thank you, Representative Swedzinski, for the question. So there's always going to be a lag when you're talking about property taxes, right, because there's the assessment year and then there's the payable year. But even before that, assessors need to see, okay, what are similar properties being sold for, right? So even before you get to the assessment year, taxable year, there's always going to be a lag in those valuations somewhat. As far as the effect, I mean, it's going to be a shift. It's not a result of policy, you know, at the county or state level necessarily, but it is a shift onto, if you're talking about those downtowns in particular, onto residential homesteads, right? I mean, as property taxes are increasing, residential homesteads are not going to just see the levy side of things, but they're going to see the shift and the overall composition of their county or city property taxes move from the commercial side, which is especially in those areas, you know, the second most significant portion, to residential homesteads. Does that answer your question?
Chair Swedzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just my understanding that, you know, usually it's maybe a 2 or a 3 year lag potentially, mm-hmm. when it comes to this, just because that market is changing so dynamically. And so it's just, you know, from a county association standpoint, just kind of how, just asking the question, like, how are you guys planning on that? Because mm-hmm. you have a little bit more of a unique set of counties you represent. And so, you know, obviously you can kind of see the tea leaves and kind of where potentially things are going as people are moving into their homes more, officing from home more, kind of flighting from downtown areas, you know, and how that's going to reflect valuations and, you know, kind of what you think. You know, I've read some articles that have said that, you know, from a real estate, commercial real estate in some large metropolitan areas that, you know, property taxes from residentials are potentially 40% of their tax base, and it's going to potentially flip where it's going to be 60% is going to come out of residential and maybe 40 to even 35% from a commercial standpoint as these trends continue.
I think that thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Swedzinski. I think your analysis is essentially correct, right? I would say that statewide right now, in 2015, I think about residential homestead made up about 40% of net tax capacity statewide, and right now that's closer to 47%. I know that doesn't sound like a huge jump, but that's a statewide number. It's going to be felt more acutely in certain counties. I do think that at the county level, when I'm talking to commissioners and staff as well, that they try to plan for this to the greatest extent they can, and they're aware of the budget trends and their local government's jurisdiction. There's also, opportunities in the current environment, too. I've been talking about commercial value. Industrial value, it's a smaller piece of the pie. But it is increasing, actually, both statewide and at the local level. But that's another factor. I don't know if Mr. Hilgard has anything to add. Okay.
Sure.
Mr. Hilgard, to that question? Or? Okay.
We're good.
Chair Swedzinski?
I'm good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Gomez?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad we're stopped on this slide, actually, about the trend in county program aid over time. Because as you can see, it's like it went from 15% to now we're like right above 6. And what that means is that, you know, basically what happened in 2002, I wasn't here, Mr. Chair was, but is that we balanced the budget by cutting essential services to schools, to counties, basically fundamentally moving the burden of paying for things off of the state coffers so that we, as state representatives and a governor and senators, got to say, oh, look what we did. Like, we fixed the deficit, right? But what we really did is we abdicated our own responsibilities under the Constitution to see to the general welfare of the people of Minnesota and pass that on to other taxing jurisdictions, mostly to property taxes. Because if you go back to Mr. Jessen's slide about own source revenue, right? Own source county revenue is 85% property taxes. And if you go to, if you look at the tax incidence study, property taxes are one of the more regressive forms of taxes that we have, second only to sales taxes. And we have a circuit breaker for low-income people. But, you know, if you look at state taxes, half of it almost is the individual income tax, which is one of the most progressive sources of revenue that we have, which means that it is like a more equitable way to fund basic services. Because when we shift those burdens onto counties, onto local governments, then it matters a lot what your adjusted net tax capacity is. That means that it matters a lot whether you're a wealthy community or not a wealthy community. That means that some of us who live in the, you know, this in the core metro have a very different calculation than some of you who live in places with lower tax capacity than we have in the metro. And so I guess this is just like to say to us, like a cautionary tale to us and to my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, right, is it can feel good to be like, oh, like we don't have to vote for tax increases here. We don't have to. And to some extent, that's like us not living in the real world, because we all live in the real world and we know that our personal budgets, what's happened to your personal budget? How much does, like, has the cost of everything just gone up and up and up? Well, that's the case for every county in the state, all 87 counties. It's have seen the costs of everything go up and up and up. And when we don't keep up on our part of the bargain as state lawmakers, drawing on this much more kind of diverse mix of revenue, of own source revenue at the state level, then we just put all of that onto our local partners, onto our school districts and our counties mostly. And we really restrict the ways that they can raise money. And so I am curious because, you know, when I was the tax chair in 2023, I brought forward a bill that, you know, it wouldn't have gotten us back to 15%, but I think our first run at it was $120 million. Biennium, and we added an inflationary factor on there. And when you have these aids that are not pegged to inflation and that are like a static amount in statute, then you get in this situation where like 20 years later, they're still trying to make up for a decision that got made, you know, in 2002 about how to balance the budget. And so, you know, when we all hear about property taxes, like, this is why. This is one of the reasons why. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. Chair Howard.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you for the presentation. I had a question. Hearing about sort of the shifts that we're seeing related to commercial versus homestead, you know, the idea of the rising property taxes has come up in the context of our housing discussion and the increased cost of housing and our massive housing shortage. And, you know, one way we can help lessen property taxes, of course, is to grow the base and build more homes. I'm curious, when you look at sort of the shifts that have happened sort of the patterns of development. Is that an area? Just curious your thoughts on sort of that. Is our housing supply shortage partly a cause and an issue that if we address could help relieve on the property tax piece too?
Mr.
Jessen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Howard, I think it's absolutely a factor, right? I haven't like dived deep into, I don't know if I'm going to give you like a really satisfactory answer right here. It's certainly a factor, especially when you're talking about, wanting value to increase generally. Mr. Hilgart may have something to add.
Mr. Hilgart.
Mr. Chair, Chair Howard, I think it's a good question because it pivots my mind into a space of just, you're thinking about increasing tax base as a solution to help with those property tax pressures. And what I think this committee has also talked about in years past is how sometimes it seems like we're shrinking tax base by creating new exemptions, exclusions, or reduced tax rates. And so that's another component that we'll talk about later in our presentation about what are the tools that we actually have policy-wise, not expenditure-wise, especially in tough times like this where we can preserve base or encourage it to grow so that that proverbial property tax pie gets bigger and folks' slices get smaller. But that's how your question prompted me to think of it that way as well.
Chair Howard?
All good. Thank you.
Okay, what we're going to do, I'm going to go to Representative Roach next, but then we're going to cut it off, finish the presentation, then all the questions in the world. Okay, Representative Roach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to thank the presenters, the testifiers, for going over this. What I'm hearing on the other side of the aisle is they acknowledge the fact that we have, costs that have been burdened onto our municipalities that, they didn't otherwise ask for. And so I hope that our colleagues on the other side of the aisle will have serious conversations in this room, in this committee, about either repealing some of these unfunded mandates that those counties never asked for, that they don't want, that they've been telling us here in this committee and in committees in the legislature that they want relief from, that they'll either work with us on repealing that or giving them an opt-out option that allows them to back out of those mandates, again, that they did not ask for, one of which is coming this year in January 1st of 2027, which is the American Preservation Act, which is going to cost counties about $1 million at least just to implement, not only to maintain. So that's all 87 counties. So I hope we can have serious discussions about that instead of just playing the games of theatrics.
Thank you, Representative Roach. Let's continue, and then I'm keeping a list for people that have questions. So who'd like to go next, Mr. Hilgart or Ms. Walls?
Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, I will continue the presentation.
But more importantly, before that, how's your ankle doing?
Mr. Chair, I'm doing pretty good. Not playing tennis yet, but maybe soon.
Okay. Maybe pickleball or something? Okay.
Not playing pickleball again, no.
Okay, Mr. Hilgart. Mr. Hilgart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And before I get to this fun question for us all, which was prompted a little earlier, because this is a question that we get by a lot of folks when we enter their offices, and I think it merits an exercise or experience of kind of what would you do in our shoes. But before I do want to recognize, one, thank you for the time that you're giving today, Mr. Chair, to this conversation and the seriousness which this committee, in a bipartisan fashion, has given counties to talk about the pressures we're facing that are, I think, very unique to us and expounded by what's been happening at a federal level as of late, too, and we'll get into that a little bit more. But secondly, I'd like to just point to the room around you today. You'll recognize that there are some new faces here, and there are county commissioners from every single corner of the state. Down here in this room with you, from Hennepin County to Fillmore County to Roseau, Clay County, et cetera, St. Louis County, driving hundreds of miles to be here. This matters. For them, the issue of property taxes is one that they hear an equal amount that you do from constituents. And so no one likes to pass those dollars down to their residents. And they're here because they take it very seriously, and they also appreciate you raising this issue this year. So let's go back to this question, which I hear quite frequently, which is, okay, well, we can't afford to increase CPA, but what mandates do you want us to get rid of? And the sad reality is that, the trend line isn't getting rid of mandates. It seems to be adding mandates to county governments. And that's fair. I mean, we understand that you have confidence in how we run our operations, that we are the social safety net of Minnesota. But we'll talk about this right now. This is a bar chart that you can see from Scott County, Minnesota. And this is them breaking down their health and human services department. And you can see in these program areas, you know, some of these programs are tens or hundreds of millions of dollars worth of either benefits or cost operations for the county, of just strictly what is mandated, must do very strictly, mandated with a little flexibility of how you do it, or that left column, which is smaller, of things that the county does for prevention and intervention things, which we believe are really cost effective in terms of driving better outcomes towards those right columns of reducing need for certain programs long-term, creating better community outputs and success. So you can just see here of just how detailed that list is. The thing that I will talk about as well is when we're talking about child welfare services, in the state of Minnesota, right now we are spending $695 million in 2024 on child welfare services. I will say this because this is an important issue that should be bipartisan. In Minnesota, we fund child welfare services through our counties more than any other state in the nation. And that is right now we are paying 41.4% of the cost of that $695 million. I think that is a concern, one, because we've seen cost increases there and there's questions about sustainability. But to Chair Gomez's point about how we use tax base to fund fundamental rights or outcomes that you want, this is not a great way to do that. Because tax bases across the state are disparate, they are diverse. And if we have a uniform standard that we want our children and families to be treated as such, I would posit that the state has an obligation to help support us to get to those outcomes. And so I am concerned about this trend line. Of the remaining, you heard me that 41% was counties. The remaining is split almost equally state of Minnesota and federal grants. So there is state and federal partnership, but again, we are the bottom state in the nation when it comes to that local match. A second thing that I wanted to talk about, this is another mandate, right? A large one on your budget sheet, but I think sometimes it's the death by 100 cuts, paper cuts. And the courts is a great example, is that we have a requirement to fund court space in our buildings. We have a requirement to fund their technology. What you see in the bottom right is just a clip shot of a bill that was sent to a county recently of, hey, we did technology improvements. We did these monitors. We added these TVs to our court space. Here's the bill. So we don't have a say on what those technologies are. We just get footed the bill for that. That's another thing that counties fund on behalf of the state. That's not in the judicial branch, but for us. The other thing that we've seen an escalatory nature in costs is court-appointed fees and counsel. So, for example, the state of Minnesota has a policy that really is strong in saying, hey, you should have court-appointed counsel in certain civil litigation or interactions with the court, but that's not paid through the judicial or state budget. So that is at a county-by-county basis. And we've seen those costs increase over years. So right now in Anoka County, you're looking at around $1 million a year in just uncompensated, unfunded costs for court-appointed counsel fees. And again, this adds up with the other things that counties are doing. So just another example of kind of an unfunded mandate. Again, all these items are things that I think on a bipartisan nature, folks say, yes, we should be doing it. But the question is the mechanism to just send this down to a local level the right mechanism to do it? I've used in this committee before the example of indigent funerals. So for folks who do not have the ability or assets to provide their family members with proper and respectful burial rights. In the state of Minnesota, there is a mandate that counties fulfill those obligations if needed. There is not an aid for that. There's not an additional offset for that. There's not federal funding that we rely on. We have counties spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, sometimes over $1 million a year, on providing funeral and burial rights for individuals. Again, a right thing to do, but something that falls down to the county levy. This next picture is a real picture from a county in our state. What I have appreciated, too, is just counties sharing just how they're engaging their public with these conversations. And I think that is an obligation of all of us. You'll notice that, Chair Markwart beefed up the truth and taxation process when he was chair here. That had bipartisan support. And now I think that you're seeing counties starting their budgeting process much sooner than the typical spring or summer before they get to their preliminary levies in September. In fact, we have counties right now that are hosting biweekly budget hearings for the public right now because of the severity of what they're in. So what you see here is almost a menu of sorts of one county saying, hey, we are projecting over $10 million of potential impacts to our county budget that we can't control. Here are the areas that we are looking to, in addition to potential property tax relief. So when we say, if we're not provided relief from these mandates, the decisions aren't just raise property taxes, they're also bad options on what to cut. Because in some counties, and counties have done analysis differently, but in some counties, the list of mandates as a percentage of their operations is 85%. So think about a business operation where 85% of your operation, you can't choose or change. So that remaining 15% is here. And it includes the undesirable option of cutting snowplow services, reducing or cutting library hour locations or services, getting rid of your co-responder models in public safety, homelessness prevention, extension services, your county fairs, or your county museums. That's really kind of the list of options that counties have left when we get to those non-funded mandates. The thing that I do want to pivot to before we get to a presentation from Ms. Walls is just the talks about shifts included in House Resolution 1. And I get, we're in a bipartisan committee here, there's going to be different takes on a House Resolution 1, the bill that was passed by the federal government in spring, on policy merits, et cetera. But I think what is non-negotiable is the idea that there are going to be costs coming to the state of Minnesota. The legislature will have a choice on whether to pass those costs down to absorb some of them, all of them, or pass those down to local governments. But I'm going to outline three areas where we could see some of those cost shifts, and we're asking you not to push these down. The first is the federal government is saying, hey, thanks for administering a federal benefits SNAP on behalf of us. We already don't pay you 100% of the cost to do that, but now we're going to cut your reimbursement by 50%, your remaining reimbursement by 50%. That amounts to about $39 million a year that the state will have to decide what to do. And again, counties, Minnesota stands, again, unique in the nation that we are already funding the administration of SNAP at a local level by property taxes more than any other state. So that is one. The second is the policy changes. This is a little bit more nebulous. The policy changes of work requirements, redetermination amounts, et cetera, that are included in HR 1. There have been cost estimates done by nonpartisan staff, but those date back to a decade ago of what work requirements potentially could mean. Regardless if you are pro or against this policy, it will require more people in the seat, proverbially at counties, doing these case redeterminations. It's now once every 6 months. And it will be now a litany of how are we verifying certain work requirements. So we'll get to what do those systems look like, what does that work look like in a moment here, but you'll see that's not an efficient process. The last one is the biggest one that could potentially impact our state, and that is what we are referring to as the SNAP error rate function. And there is a Medicaid error rate, too, which will be effective in January 1st of 2029, but the one looming closer is the SNAP error rate. And the idea here is that the federal government will be assigning states to take up a percentage of the overall SNAP value. So the value of benefits that go up to Minnesota, state of Minnesota will be on the hook for a portion of those depending on where their error rate is. And in Minnesota, we are very concerned that the state might want to pass those error rates down to county governments. And those amount in the hundreds of millions. And I would say also that the error rate is a complete misnomer. And we'll get into that right now, too. This is an example in Scott County. So in Scott County, they processed 4,000 SNAP cases last year. Of those 4,000, 10 were reviewed. Of those 10, the 10 cases represented $2,100 in total benefits. $149 was found to be an error. And we'll see here in the demonstration how easily errors can be made both internally but also from a client face. That error rate would have Scott County on the hook for $1 million payment if that was passed on to Scott County. So again, $149 error costing Scott County residents potentially $1 million. This is very serious. And I think this is what counties across the state are talking about right now as they're budgeting. When you are talking about budgeting, the next page, please, Nathan, thank you. When you are talking about budgeting, We are seeing these numbers need to be refreshed because the bottom chart is way low than what we're actually seeing counties right now talk about. I just had a county respond back to me yesterday that's saying, hey, Matt, we're estimating 8 to 11% impact, just straight up levy increase right off the bat if the SNAP error rate is passed down to us. That's an 8 to 11% automatic levy increase if those costs are passed down. That's before employment, that's before collective bargaining agreements, that's before health insurance, that's before any other mandates that we're talking about. So when Mr. Jessen talks about the property tax levies from last year being historic, I am very fearful that next year will also be historic if we don't do something about this. And that brings me to my last slide before you see what is, I think, the most compelling presentation of the day. Mr. Chair has seen it, and I thank you for sending it to live. But that is, what's in front of you right now is a picture of the screens and infrastructure we use. Because you might be asking, well, why don't we control this error rate? How do we get below that error rate so we don't have a penalty? We agree, we want to get below this error rate too. But as you've heard a common trend here, Minnesota stands alone. Minnesota stands alone. We also stand alone in the fact that we are operating a lot of our health and human services systems on systems that date back to the 1980s. Ms. Walls will be doing a presentation right here to show you a day in the life of a caseworker. But as you see this presentation, please think about this from a multitude of perspectives. Please think about this from a perspective of a worker who is getting hired right now, looking to serve individuals and family, coming into the social work profession to help people, and getting to work and seeing this as their login screen. Spending 30 minutes inputting an address into a system. Having numerous people call you every day saying, where am I in the queue? And the system doesn't actually have an internal queue that says where they are. Desperate for help. Think about this from a county budget perspective. When you're saying we need co-respondo models, we need more investments here, we need more investments in public safety, we need to have another plow because we're getting complaints that we're not clearing streets fast enough, and saying, I'm sorry, we have to hire 60 eligibility workers because right now our case ratio for SNAP applications is 1 person to 300 cases, where the next state over is 1 to 900, and some states are 1 to over 1,000. So we are 300% less efficient than other states in these systems. So think about that just from a property tax perspective. And the last one is think about it from a client perspective, from someone who is desperately seeking medical care and might even need a medical procedure and is trying to get through medical assistance and is eligible for that, but is waiting weeks or months to figure out where they are in this system. And I know you get those calls too, from county commissioners get those calls, and you get those calls. And so as Ms. Walls goes through that, I ask you to watch that and also put yourself in the perspective of that. And then after that, you'll hear a couple county commissioners, and then we'll be done for the day. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hilgert. And before we go to Ms. Walls, we meet every year with the Fillmore County Commissioners, and they asked me if I could stay after a little bit. So I went to Health and Human Services, and they had me sit down and try to enter, some fake people in. And the first thing I thought was, where's the mouse? they didn't have a mouse. And then I went to probably the best university in history, Winona State University. And I looked at the course catalog, and there were no courses in DOS. Okay, Ms. Walls.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll move the mic a little closer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. My name is Kathleen Walls. I'm a public assistance program trainer, and I work for Dakota County. So it's my job to train our new hires to become eligibility workers. A lot of my time is spent teaching people how to navigate and how to use the system we call MAXIS. MAXIS was new in 1989, and we are still using it to determine eligibility and issue benefits for SNAP, cash assistance, emergency assistance, and some Medicaid programs. So what I'm going to show you today is just a little window into a day in the life of an eligibility worker or financial worker that works at one of our Minnesota counties. So what I've done is I've created a fictional case of a client who's applying for SNAP and cash assistance. What I'm going to show you is the approval process. What I'm not going to show you is the 45 minutes it took me to enter this information manually into MAXIS. Okay? So I took the information on this 9-page application, I entered it in manually, and what we're going to do today is we're going to approve benefits for this fake client in the training region of MAXIS. So you have a handout. It's colorful. One part of it says Maxis Navigation. This is a cheat sheet that's available to our financial workers to help them understand how to navigate in Maxis, because we cannot use the mouse. Using the mouse creates a lot of issues. We have to navigate using the keyboard alone, okay? So that's the first page of your handout. The second page is a list of the functions and screen features within Maxis. So this is a helpful tool for our financial workers. If they forget where to go or how to do something, this is a reminder. All right, so let's get into it. Like I said, I have created a fake application in the training region of Maxis. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you the panels or the screens that I entered that information into, and then I'm going to approve the case. So I'm going to just scroll through all of the screens. And I apologize, Maxis is a little slow this morning. This is not unusual. So what I've done is I requested to view all the panels. And so we're not going to take you through all the panels today. Like I said, Maxis is a little slow. So in the interest of time, I'm just going to show you the jobs panel. So this panel is the screen where we enter earned income information for a client. It is so important for generating the correct budget for both cash assistance and SNAP. And what I want you to know is that there are so many ways in Maxis to make a very simple mistake that affects the budget and creates an error or an overpayment for our clients and for our financial workers. So on this panel, we've entered the earned income for our client. Any applicant, we see that she's earning $344 gross monthly income from Speedy Market. We have to enter that information three times on this panel. So once on the front, a second time on this FS pick pop-up that I'll just pull up here, you see again 344 gross monthly income for this client. And then again, we have a cash pick pop-up. The exact same information is entered a third time on this one panel. Another panel I want to point out is the work registration panel. This is also very important to get the correct results for SNAP and cash. It's also very confusing to learn how to code correctly. Fortunately, we do have 9 different handouts that were developed by the state to help workers understand just how to code this one screen correctly. 9 different handouts, and one of them is 16 pages long.
Let's let her finish first. You're on the list here, Representative Elkins.
I know she is in the presentation because I've seen it, but where is this data coming from?
Where is this data coming from?
That you're typing.
So I have the 9-page
handout?
The information on the application that I created, this fictional application, I have entered manually into Maxis.
And where did this come from? Somebody's paycheck stub?
Yeah, so this would have come from, yes, exactly, the client saying I'm not able to work because I'm disabled, or they provided paycheck stubs, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Thank you.
Paper sources.
Yep.
Yes. And yes, that's a good point. Even if we get applications submitted electronically, Maxis does not interface with those electronic applications, so we have to still enter those manually. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to show you the approval process for both cash and SNAP. And what I have to do is I have to use the manual override function because Maxis does not even interface with its own screens. So what I have to do is, these are my eligibility results. I'm going to use the manual override function, it's called FIAT, to approve the cash assistance first because cash is countable for the SNAP budget. Okay, so I'm going to enter into the cash FIAT menu. I'm going to view my case budget and my case test. We see that this client is appearing eligible. That's what we expect. Now I want to point out this first budget page, earned income. If you remember, she has $344 a month of gross monthly earned income, which has not been pulled into this budget. So I have to enter this again manually. And if I forget, I will have the incorrect budget. Okay. Or if I wrote it down incorrectly.
So that's the fourth entry, right?
This is the fourth entry. Thank you. Yes. All right. I also have to update the reporting status because Maxis doesn't get that correct either. I'm going to save this version. So I have now created a version of correct eligibility for cash assistance just for the month of March. Now, typically, I would have to do this for the month of April as well, but in the interest of time, I will skip that. It's the exact same process. So what I'm going to do now is we're going to do the manual override function to approve SNAP to include cash assistance in the SNAP budget. So I'm going to pick my reason code that's different from the cash assistance. I'm going to enter down to food support, and we're going to view the budget. All right, I see that the public assistance grants have not been taken into account into the SNAP budget, so I have to open this pop-up window, this PA grants, enter down to GA for general assistance, and I really hope I wrote down the general assistance amount correctly because I have to remember to include that here in the SNAP budget, even though we've already approved the general assistance. Okay. So now we have the general assistance included into the SNAP budget, and the SNAP benefit amount would change. So the SNAP benefit amount has now decreased due to the inclusion of the general assistance cash. All right. So
is this the same system Cargill uses?
I am unaware.
I hope not.
All right. So I'm going to save this version of Fiat, and then I can go ahead and actually finish the approval. But the take-home message here is that there are so many ways that we can make a very simple error. And really, to determine eligibility, we can't just use the software. We have to use paper and pencil, right? We have to take notes. We have to remember these figures for the many, many cases that we would touch in a day. And there's many opportunities for error and overpayment.
2 years to become fluent in these systems.
Yes, and I like I said, I'm a trainer, so my job is to teach people how to do this job. And I would say it does take 2 years to become competent, confident, and sufficient in your work as a financial worker.
Okay, we'll go to questions and members. We also are fortunate to have two other testifiers, a Fillmore County Commissioner and Stearns County Commissioner. But let's go through some questions while these folks are right here, and then we'll go to the other witnesses. Okay, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. As a former county commissioner, I'm taking a lot of this to heart, and I'm doing a lot, trying to do a lot for this. And I went and pretended I got hired at Washington County and sat down and for this. And I said, that's it, I quit after the first page. I just said I walked out. It's like I'm done. And because it's just unbelievable what you have to go through. One of the things that I wanted just to address here earlier too, just take the opportunity, Representative Howard talked about extra houses being built. Would that help the budget? And being also a city council member, new homes don't necessarily make things better, because you also you have to think about what extra services. You're hiring extra police, you're having extra snow plows, you're having extra sewer, all that stuff. So as your community grows, people expect that all of a sudden the tax will get lower, but you have all this infrastructure that you're paying for up front. And apartments are good. Senior housing creates even more infrastructure issues. So that doesn't happen. But am I correct in what my learning is that one in three states, we're only one of three states that require the county to administer the SNAP program?
Yeah, one of
them. Mr. Hilger?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I believe we are either one of nine or one of 10 states where we administer the SNAP benefit at a county level.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to get clarification. I know it was amazingly low, but one of the things that right now the counties are on the line and they're dealing with this, but think about if you were an employee and you were hired and you're paid a amount of money, and then you were given something that said, here's a program that is set up to have errors. Here is handwritten paperwork that somebody filled out somewhere that you need to put in. And then if there are any errors, we're going to deduct your pay. How many people would stay at that job and think that's fair? That's basically what's happening at the county, is they're being penalized because of a program that's not theirs, paperwork that is out of date from what I could see, out of date, that's being handwritten, filled out, sent to you, and you're supposed to make sense of it, put it in, and then if it's wrong, you're getting fined for doing it. So I think it's just the whole process is set up wrong. And I think it's an example of what the burden we're putting on our counties. And that's why I have a bill that I'm hoping to have on my desk tomorrow and then in the hopper, was to make sure that counties are held harmless until a program is replaced and a system is set up that they can actually succeed in. And that's what I think as we talk about the costs that are putting down, because those error rates are going to be devastating, but don't even take into account the inefficiencies that counties are paying for right now with how many people are required to use this program. You said 2 years, I've heard 1 year, you know, to learn it even decent. And you think nowadays, what's the turnover of people? And if you go and sit down in front of a computer without a mouse, how long do you think the people are going to stay around and say, I can do this somewhere else for a lot more money? So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Lee.
Oh, thank you, Chair. Okay, so I wanted to go back to that slide using Scott County as an example. And actually also have a question for Ms. Walls, because I want folks to just understand what the error rate means. Can you explain maybe, and I don't know if you have the data here, you know, sometimes error rates are overpayments or also underpayments to clients, right? And I want to know if maybe you could, like, split that up from the data from the Scott County example.
Ms. Walls or Mr. Hilgert?
I think I'll try, and then if Ms. Walls wants to add on, I think that would be helpful too, because the error rate that I, Representative Lee is correct that these can be underpayments, they can be overpayments. They can be client-driven errors, they could be agency-driven errors. We would argue that the agency-driven errors, i.e., is very largely responsible by our technology. But I think a good example is someone who is applying for SNAP benefits. Let's say that they're applying in December, and they are at a job making $16 an hour. They are eligible, they get their SNAP benefits. They are responsible for updating their work every month if their wages change. But let's say that they got hired in December at $16 and their union agreement has them getting a 25-cent raise starting in January. And they don't know that. They didn't read it, they missed that. They're assuming, I just got hired, I'm gonna be at $16. When we pull that reassessment data, when we relook at their case every 6 months, we see, oh, hey, your wages changed. Right? You didn't report that. What we're going to do is change the future benefit, potentially. So we will have caught that error. That error happened. That exists. They unintentionally, hopefully, did not report that wage data. We caught it. We're going to garnish that future benefit and reduce that benefit so that the taxpayer and benefit is whole. Yet that is still counted as an error. And I think that is something that we are spending, you see the folks in this room today, a lot of these same folks have been going out to DC talking to every single member of Congress saying that policy makes no sense whatsoever. That error rate definition does not make sense at all. It punishes us. And one thing I'll say that is especially egregious, I think, is that the error rate policy right now says your penalty gets progressively higher, the higher error rate you have, until a certain amount. If you're really, really, really bad, you're exempt from the error rate for 2 years. So the states of Alaska and I believe Maine are actually twice as high as Minnesota's error rate, and yet they aren't facing the same potential consequences as us. So that is something that is a federal, we believe, policy change, the error rate definition that we would like to see changed as well, especially getting that client-driven errors off of kind of the responsibilities. Did I miss anything?
Okay, very good. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. So thank you. I just want to make sure folks understand as we talk about potential fraud that just because there's this error rate doesn't mean that people are getting money they're not entitled to, and that there are a whole host of other issues with the definition of error rate. But I think the larger issue here is maybe if we can go back to slide 13. HR 1 was extremely harmful to our country and our state budget as state legislators. Folks should understand, and I think the county commissioners here understand too, the federal government decided to shift millions of dollars of cost onto state and county governments, all to fund corporate tax subsidies and tax cuts for billionaires. And so you see here this chart that the administrative fees have been shifted onto to state governments. And next year, you know, we will have a decision on how we want to pay for that, right? That's in this first column. And if we go to slide 15, I guess Mr. Hilgart just explain maybe like where this estimate is from for the $125 million shift to Minnesota?
Mr. Hilgart?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, yes, I'm pulling up that page right now. What we are assuming here is we're basically assuming the orange column and the blue column in effect in Minnesota. And so the administrative cost shift, as you mentioned, the one that takes effect October 1st, 2026, we'll be budgeting for in this upcoming cycle. If that was passed down to counties, that's approximately $39 million of potential liability. The blue column that we are assuming is the error rate for SNAP. Once that is in effect, which is October 1st, 2027, that potentially is $86 million a year for Minnesota. Now, what I will say is we are unfortunately at the precipice of our error rate going one tier higher. So that $86 million is more likely $120 million error. When you count those two up, the total liability that we have right here is $125 million annually when both of these are in effect. And how we divide that, we take that number representatively and we divide it out on each county's share of those things, both the administrative rate and their portion of the error rate of their total benefits in their county right now. So the numbers that you're seeing are the numbers there. But again, I think these numbers will be higher, and what we are hearing from our counties is that these numbers that we use as examples are unfortunately a little low than what we're seeing as the average of folks coming back to us and telling us that they're planning to potentially budget for.
Thank you, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. I mean, this is a very frightening slide for me, and I think a lot of my colleagues here, of how we'll make sure that next year people continue to be fed. I've had a meeting this morning with a variety of stakeholders who are in my community and across the state who are really concerned about this. And so I think it's really helpful that we're having this discussion here, and it seems like, you know, folks on the other side are hopefully also concerned about this. But I think we have to look beyond just fixing the technology, right? Like, there are larger questions of how we want to pay for the things that we care about. And, you know, my last reflection is that, you know, unfortunately, this federal regime has set up really perverse incentives. I observe Alaska and Maine are probably some of the places that are very gettable to support our Republican president, whereas Minnesota is a state that has consistently not voted for this president. And so, to me, I see this very much as punishing our state and the people here who've done nothing to harm the regime. So, thank you.
Okay, members, if we could cut the tone on some of the political rhetoric here a little bit, that'd be very helpful. And I do want to assure this committee that this side of the aisle is very concerned about these issues too. That's why we're hearing them. So let's, you know, DC this, DC that. Let's just drop that stuff and let's talk about counties. And I know that stuff that's happened out there does affect the state and counties. But if we could just take the rhetoric down a little bit, that would be much appreciated. We're going to go. I've got a whole list, and I want everybody to be able to get their questions asked. I think what we're going to do now, we've had folks drive in from some distance, Commissioner Mitch Lentz from Fillmore County, if you want to join us here. So here's kind of the rest of the meeting. And then we'll go to Commissioner Terrell Clark back there. Okay, Terrell Clark, why don't you two get up here? And if you three could kind of stick around, but let's let the two county commissioners talk here. And then we'll ask them questions, and then we're going to hear my bill. So we're going to get off of the presentation, which has been amazing. Thank you, Mr. Jessen. Thank you, Mr. Hilgart and Ms. Walls. It's been a great presentation. As far as I'm concerned, you're knocking out of the park, making us aware of what we need to be looking at as a legislature and as a tax committee. So after the two commissioners talk here, then we're going to go to my bill. Then the time that's left, we have to be out here at noon. Then we're going to go back to questions of Mr. Hilgart, if you could stick around, Mr. Jensen, Ms. Walls. Okay. Okay. Mr. Lentz, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
My name is Mitch Lentz. I'm Fillmore County Commissioner. Mr. Chair and members, I thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today on a growing property tax concerns facing our county. Fillmore County is a small rural county. We're just a little over 21,000, so we're very small. Our population is aging and not growing, which makes sustaining services increasingly difficult. To give you a sense of scale, a 1% levy increase in Fillmore County is just a little over $100,000. Not a big number. In a county with limited tax base, even small funding shifts have a significant impact on us. Based on federal and state policy changes being discussed earlier, Minnesota counties could see hundreds of millions annually in reduced administrative funding and SNAP error rate penalties. For Fillmore County, that translates to roughly several hundreds of thousands of dollars, immediately adding multiple percentage points to our levy. Therefore, accounting for other critical needs of our counties may have not alone to mention the mandates. The question we are trying to understand is very simple. If these federal dollars disappear, will the state replace them, or will the counties be expected to absorb them through our property taxes? There are no other options. We cannot not do this work. We're required by law. We don't have a choice. And our residents also expect someone to provide this service to them. For small counties like ours, we turn more and more to efficiency, collaboration, and creativity. Unfortunately, the technology we rely on is very outdated, as you've seen, and time-consuming. Our eligibility workers still navigate green screens to communicate with one that do not communicate or work together with each other. Representative Davids, thank you. And I feel sorry for you for sitting with our staff and trying to navigate through this system.
That was brutal.
Firsthand to see how difficult this process
was. That
was
brutal. Yes.
Modernizing these systems could make an enormous difference to counties like Fillmore and all other counties. And frankly, coming from the private sector, retiring after 45 years of service with IBM, I am astonished to me how antiquated these technologies we've been given to work with at the county. This was a very good platform back in 1970 when I started. It's 2026, folks. There have been no changes. Fillmore County has 9 eligibility workers who administer programs like medical assistance and SNAP. These workers aren't just government staff. They serve our neighbors, friends, and at times family members. They sit across from parents worried about losing medication for coverage for a child. They answer calls from our seniors confused about renewal notices, and they talk with families facing eviction or utility shutoffs. Over the past several years, we've implemented wave after wave of policy changes. Medicaid renewals restarting, new staff work requirements, expanded verification rules, repeated system updates. Any one change might be manageable. Taken together, they have fundamentally increased the complexity and emotional strain of this work. What has grown most is not just workload, it's the moral weight of this job. Staff get into these positions to help people. They don't do this to enter needless data. They do it to help people. And yet, they spend hours helping residents navigate these confusing system notices that create fear and uncertainty amongst families needing the help the most. They do this work with professionalism and compassion, but in a team of 9 experienced staff members, one individual leaving will severely disrupt this service we provide in Fillmore County. And it doesn't help that training someone to operate these systems takes many months, if not years, to master this technology. Learning to do a SNAP application right now should not be as hard as learning a foreign language, and that's what we have today. And I'd take my chances with the foreign language. Our request today is very simple. Please recognize the property tax pressures for counties are tied to your work. Not just your work, the policies, the state passes, and the tools we're given to actually collect revenue and pay for it all. When policy change has happened, the administrative capacity to implement must also be part of your conversation. Whether through adequate funding, realistic staffing formulas, modernization technologies, counties need the tools to administer these programs effectively. The state and federal government cannot expect that we can deliver all that you want simply by raising another percentage point or two on our levies. We know that these programs are lifelines for our residents, but I also know that I have a responsibility to create a livable and affordable community for the residents. And I worry about this every day, and it's becoming harder and harder. I want to thank you for your time and for your consideration, the realities counties face on the ground, and I appreciate the seriousness of which you're taking this issue, and to Chair Davids for his attention and our partnership to this story. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Lentz, for that testimony. Questions for Commissioner Lentz from committee members? Okay, thank you very much. If you just stick around a little bit here. Next, we will have Commissioner Terrell Clark, Stearns County. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, and members. I'm Terrell Clark. I'm a Stearns County Commissioner. I serve as president of the Minnesota Inter-County Association. I have also the honor of serving on the AMC board, and I'm a past chair of Health and Human Services. I'm not telling you that for like anything except for I get to serve with a whole lot of really great people. And I look around this room, every one of us works hard. We try to listen and learn from each other and our constituents. We have a lot to do. We also have a really great job, right? Everything is so interconnected and we want to do well. But as you've heard, we're oftentimes just told what to do and then figure out how to pay for it. And so this puts that extra burden that you were hearing earlier. Every policy change, every single policy change that comes, whether it's through the federal or the state legislature, means additional costs, additional time, additional changes. And Commissioner Lentz, I believe Maxis actually comes from 1989, so I'm sure in 1993 when PRISM came, it seemed new. Right around all those, it's still really old. So we have staff, as you've heard, that weren't born when this system was done. We don't have people out there that can cobble this together. And so from a county perspective, what I keep hearing too, and because of a couple of the questions earlier, you know, that this old technology that we're required to use just exacerbates the cost and the problems. As you heard, we have awesome staff that want to be creative, want to just do the job, want to put the right information in. But between 30 and 50% of the time of our human services staff, depending on which of these programs you use, can be all focused on just entering and reentering. We didn't mention yet that every time somebody has a baby, you got to close the case and start this all over. Oh, you got to put in people? Well, that's PNL person, that's PNLP, right? These codes don't make sense. Once upon a time, I was a senior law project attorney, and I also did public benefits. One shouldn't need an attorney to apply for Medicaid, and you shouldn't need these 2 years to be able to do the forms, right? We could do better, and technology could allow us to do that. It could be a totally front end where we could see what people are needing. They're able to upload the information. But on the back end, we don't have to redo this all the time. The error rates that you were hearing, I do want to just reinforce again. Let's say my good friend Mitch here tells me his salary is 100, and then we figure out it's really 150.12. I put in 150.12 on 20 different screens, and then I mess up and put 150.21. We now have an error rate. So regardless of how this has come about, we have an opportunity now with partnering with you to fix this. The kinds of fixes we're asking this year can make a difference on our taxpayers. They can make a difference on the people we serve. Frankly, they'll make a difference on program integrity. And in our case, on this one policy change, so if we're talking about SNAP, you are hearing about the potential error rate and administrative costs if they would shift to property taxes. That would be roughly a 3.63% increase just for this, and a total increase of $3.7 million. This is not actually more efficiency, right? It's not going to actually help anybody. But with the kinds of opportunities that we can work together on, we can help keep our property taxes low. Around this room, we all struggle every year with raising levies. This is one of the hardest things we can do. And as some of you know, I used to serve in the other body. It is hard when you are raising taxes, right? Mm-hmm. We don't have a choice because we have to balance our budget this way. So two quick stories, and then I know both of us would be more than happy to answer any questions. These are local ones, right? I have a constituent who is disabled. She would qualify for the property tax deferral. She's just old enough, and she somehow got a house for, I can't even believe how she got this house for this price, but she hasn't lived there for 5 years, so she doesn't qualify. She was begging to see if there was any way we could give her a special change, right, on her property taxes, because her homeowner's insurance has gone up, right? So we're kind of stacking all these things up, and she can't figure out what to do. So, you know, one thing to consider is maybe you shouldn't have to wait 5 years because you'll still get it back, right? Then the other one that was really interesting was I was at a local, you know, group of people. Let's call it a book group, but it was a little broader than that, where people were talking. They had just gotten their tax statements. They were hopping mad. They were actually hopping mad about the city part of it. They looked at our part, and they said, they actually, to a number, said, oh, this is because the state has passed on all these costs to you. They understood why ours were going up, but it's not okay. We kept ours down at least somewhat this year. We're all very worried about next year. So we know that some of this is for other committees, but if you can help us with making sure when you're looking at what are the property, potential property tax impacts on what is being passed in your committees, what is the potential workforce impacts, what is the potential technology, it would probably help us all do much better by our residents in Minnesota. So thank you. I'm certainly stand for questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Clark. Any questions for the commissioner? Representative Woody.
Thank you, Chair Davids. I'll keep it quick. Thank you, commissioners, for what you're doing. I know it, a lot's been put on you guys. My quick question to Commissioner Clark. This is my second term up here. I believe you guys have been up here before talking to us about this computer screens. Can you tell me when that was?
Commissioner Clark?
Mr. Chair and Representative Witt, we've been coming for quite a while, but we've needed to really push harder in the last few years. We were here last year, obviously. We thank you for the resources that were given to start dealing with a different program. But this is complex because they're all old. And so, yes, as recently as last year, but we have been here before.
Okay, and what I'm going to be, Representative Woody.
Thank you. I was just going to just reiterate, we're all up here fighting to help people, and these systems are making it tough for them to get it and frustrating for them. So we need to do better. We do have to take this a little more serious and obviously fix this so it can really get to the root problem of making sure that the people we are talking about trying to help get what they get in a good, timely manner. So thank you guys for all you're doing.
Thank you, Representative Witte. And I'm going to be asking House Fiscal to meet with me afterwards. House Fiscal, I don't need the answer right now, but let's talk afterwards. I remember, not that well anymore, but I remember we put $200 million into computer systems for, I think it was HHS or something. Where'd that go? So let's think about that. Okay. Okay. Commissioners, thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Mr. Lentz, Ms. Clark, thank you so much. What I am going to do now is I am going to shift to my bill, and then I've got a long list of questions, and I want to get to every one of them that we can. This bill shouldn't take long. I will move House File 3396. I will now move the A1 amendment. Any questions on the amendment? All in favor, I'll move it. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion prevails on the A1 amendment. We now have 3396 as amended. And what this bill does is it establishes a property tax task force, which I think right now is, after today's meeting, a very important thing to do. We're not voting on this. We'd open up for questions for members. And if there are any, I'll just lay it over for possible inclusion. But I think there may be some questions on membership of the task force. I've had some folks talk to me about that. So I'm open to talking about all of those issues. So any questions, Representative Elkins? I think you should be on it.
Thank you. I would volunteer to be on this. But I think we should probably have a few more members. I suspect that there are lots of people who might want to be on this.
Okay. Okay. Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would also suggest you would add the Minnesota Association of Metropolitan School Districts. The MSBA is the bigger umbrella, and maybe even look at Minnesota Rural Educators Association, because, you know, property taxes and the way it interacts with school districts affect is very different across the entire state. So maybe.
And I totally agree. Yeah. Totally agree. I am certainly open to that. And also, I think we should probably have some of the folks that are paying the property taxes on here, whether it be the chamber or NFIB or business partners, somebody like that. So I am totally open to other groups that should be on this. But I really think, especially after today's hearing, I'm going, oh, my gosh, yeah, we need this thing. Representative Norris.
Thank you, Chair Davids. I was just going to highlight that I've got a similar bill. I was going to say it's probably a situation of great minds thinking alike, but, you know, probably more just we're hearing the same things from our constituents and from, you know, some of the folks around here at the Capitol as well. And so looking forward to, I think mine is a little bit more focused on just the residential side, but looking forward to working with you on trying to come up with something along these lines, because I think it really would be beneficial for our state.
I think, are you scheduled for a hearing yet?
I think next week we're going
to. Next week? Okay, that's great. I'd like to work with you on that. We'll have your people talk to my people, and we'll get something put together.
Let's do it.
Okay. So any other questions? I will move House File 3396 as amended later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. And Representative Norris, I do want to sit down with you on this, if we could. Okay. Now, let's go to very important questions, and we might get through them. I don't want to cut off any questions. These are very important questions, so why don't we could we get the two commissioners back here, and Mr. Hilgard, Mr. Jessen, and was it Ms. Walls? Ms. Walls, I think? Yeah, Walls, Kathleen Walls. Maybe if we just get you all up there, and members, we can direct our questions to any one of the five people that have testified today. And again, while they're getting situated, counties, we love you. We know we have work to do. We have a lot of work to do. And I think this committee will be engaged and really want to help out on some of these issues that we can. And whatever the feds have done, whatever's going on, we are where we are. Let's make it work. Okay. Representative Elkins, you're next. And then I've got Robbins, Witte, Gomez, Anderson, Kozlowski, Hewitt, and Swedzinski, and anybody else we'll put at the list, and we'll just go till noon, see what we can get out of this. And again, Mr. Hilgard, as always, Jessen, good job. This was a very, very good meeting today, it'll continue to be a good meeting. Representative Elkins.
A couple questions. First one would be for Ms. Walls. You talked about the two-year process of getting through the training. About what percentage of your trainees actually make it all the way through the 2 years?
Thank you for the question, Representative Elkins.
And how many request hazard pay?
Yeah. My best
Ms. Walls.
Guess. Oh yeah, my best guess is about 50%, maybe. It's Jeez. We have an extremely high turnover rate.
Yeah.
Which for me is job security, but really that's not what we want, right?
Representative Elkins.
Yeah, I just want to observe that this particular system is an enabler of a tremendous amount of the fraud as well, because it cannot be interfaced with any authoritative sources for payroll information or any of the other information that's required to complete this form. It's easy to, create a fake account, fake the numbers, and there's just, because it cannot be interfaced with any other system, there's just no good way other than manually to do checks on any of the data that's being entered, and no good way to share the data here with other related systems as well.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Point well taken. Ms. Walz, I've got a question quick here. On this, I think one of the things that bothers me the most about all this is the error rate and what that's going to do to our counties. Now, okay, we have the workers putting in, they can make an error. Okay, that's one thing. But when it's a client-based error, that counts against us too?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is correct. Yes.
Well, you had nothing to do with that.
That is also correct.
Why'd you set it up this way? Okay, we got a lot of work to do, folks. Okay, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to all of our testifiers, thank you for coming. So I have a lot of concerns. On the error rate, especially talking about the client error rate, someone talked about, you know, getting the information from the client about, say, their salary. So is that based on documentation or attestation?
Is that for Ms. Walz?
Sure.
Ms. Walz.
Thank you, Representative. So that is based on information that we ask from the client. So the client has certain responsibilities to report things to us, and we act on that information. So we have applications for each program that we administer, and there's certain information, and the client may or may not answer things correctly or fully, and it's our job to kind of expand on the questions on the application and look for more information, make sure everything is lining up, and if it doesn't, to request further information.
Representative Robbins.
So I don't feel like I got the answer. Is it attestation, what they tell you, or is it documented?
Thank you. Yes, so.
Ms. Walz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are certain things that we require documentation of. So, for example, income. We require paper verification or a copy. There are certain things that we accept client attestation of, for example, state residence. People say, I'm living in the state of Minnesota. If it's not questionable, we don't request further verification.
Richard Robbins.
Could you provide me a list of what you require documentation for and what you rely on attestation for?
Ms. Walz? Can you? Mr. Hilger?
I think, yeah, Chair Davids, Representative Robbins, I think my question, too, is I assume these are state policies, so we'll circle back with Ms. Walz and others of saying, is there a comprehensive list of what you've got to?
Thank
well,
you.
How, what if we had House Research do that? Yeah. Who would do that? Mr. Cole? We'll figure it out. We'll figure it out.
Thank you.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I'm also very concerned about the error rate, and I agree. Like, this system is a disaster, right? But I'm concerned about we're going to make a change. We desperately need to make a change. And I have advocated, along with the OLA, for about 6 years, that we have a group from all the different agencies, including also the counties, and maybe that's what the task force will do. But, like, we need to make sure this is enterprise-wide, that the systems talk to each other. And I've heard anecdotally that different departments are already going out on bids for technology upgrades that won't necessarily all work together. So I'm begging you, Mr. Chair, and Co-Chair Gomez, and everybody else in other committees, that we find a group that will work on this together so that we're not spending money, that we get a system that doesn't work across the enterprise. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. Representative Witte.
Thank you, Chair Davids. Representative Elkins, I agree with you on your comments about the paper and the system creating the fraud. This is part of it. On these paper forms that are coming in, does it say anything about being punishable by a crime if it's false? Understanding that there's certain levels. There's a checks and balance, but if you actually find a fraud up front, can you do anything about it?
Who's that directed at?
Ms. Walz.
Ms. Walz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. Yes, so when clients fill out an application for benefits, they have rights and responsibilities, and there are penalties and qualification questions that they have to answer. And the answer is yes. So there are things that we can do. We can pursue fraud if we believe that there's fraud happening. I don't have a lot of information on that, but we can certainly get some for you.
Representative Witte.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And I'd be curious, you know, what rate that is caught at that level. Because I do think if you upgrade your system, you would have safety nets to prevent you from going elsewhere. And I think it would also, through AI and stuff like that, would be able to detect a little bit more and the systems talking together. So I do think that would be a very helpful piece here. The start at this level, I think, is Representative Elkins are kind of getting at.
To that point, Mr. Hilgard.
Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, you saw my excitement there.
I do, but it's okay.
I think the combination of Chair Robbins' last point and Representative Witte's point go hand in hand. The systems need to be able to talk to each other, and right now they are completely siloed. The fact that you can't do address searches cleanly in these systems at all for verification is a problem. We saw a vendor presentation just recently where other states are having SNAP applications being processed, having there's AI components as well, but there is robust program integrity features of self-documentation, asking about if you live at a residence, when was your mortgage started, what was the holder of that mortgage, what are the levels. So they're going through verification in real time as they're applying, again, third-party, private parties that are doing this. And the great thing of this is, one, it's happening quicker, better, more comprehensively. The systems are talking to each other. But also some of these state systems, whether it's New Mexico or Colorado, are self-approving when they've met all those metrics so that it doesn't even come into Ms. Walls's caseload. So when we go back to what we talked about earlier today, when Wisconsin, our neighboring state, is right now in the process of modernizing their systems, because they're not happy about only having 900 cases per one caseworker, and we're at 300, and they're not happy about theirs and they're updating, this is what they're updating to. And so the abilities going through private vendors, things like that, are much more comprehensive, but it takes a roadmap. It takes putting the shovel in the ground, which we are really hopeful the legislature finds a way to do. There are federal match dollars for these programs, which is critical to also consider. And it takes a vision, and we would argue that that vision can't just have county consultation. A lot of these program updates we've seen, even with the best of intent, if counties aren't at the table writing the systems that we ourselves operate, there are going to be problems. And we might actually have lessons learned with some of these vendors where we say, be careful. This is not, be careful what you wish for here. We actually have proven experience where this isn't a reliable system or there are key functionality and components left out. So I know sometimes expanding the table to have more power in these IT decisions, I get it. Agencies are a little weary of. But we are asking this year that if there is a solution that is going forward with really investing in these systems, that we actually have a power and say of what these systems look like in the future.
Representative Witte.
Thank you. My last comment. We do need to have the stakeholders at the table. We make better decisions when we work together and we have the people there. And I know it's uncomfortable at times, but we do have to have those key stakeholders. And we got to start working a little smarter, not as harder as it sounds, and maybe her rate would go up, but it'll also protect us from some of these error rates and some of these other things so we could catch things. So thank you guys for all your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Witte. Say, before we go to Chair Gomez here, and then I've still got some on the list, which is great, I had a witness for my bill. Oh. Beth Johnson. Are you here?
I'll move my table.
Okay, were you for it?
Yeah.
Okay, then you'll be allowed to talk if you'd like, but it already passed. So just, okay, good. Read the book, Shut Up and Sell. You got the deal? That's good, right? Okay, so I apologize for that because I'm sure you'd been very good, but now you're on the record so you can claim mileage. Okay, very good. Okay, very good. Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just... I guess I have a question. So for Ms. Walls, I don't know how your name's spelled, so I don't know how it's pronounced.
W-E-L-L-S.
But Walls. Okay. My understanding is that the changes in HR 1 will require Medicaid, what do you call them, reauthorizations basically, or like eligibility checks twice a year instead of once a year. And like, does that process happen in this black screen situation?
Ms. Walls?
Thank you, Chair Gomez. So some of the Medicaid redeterminations do have to happen in the MAXIS system. Most of them happen within the MET system, which has a graphical user interface which is much more friendly and updated looking. However, I would posit that most folks who work with the MET system wish that they were working in MAXIS because it is so bad.
Wait, okay.
Worse?
Sorry, it's worse. Yes. You're saying
Chair
the other
system. The word okay, is worser.
So are you saying people working in the other system wish they were in this?
Thank you. Yes, I that's exactly what I'm saying.
We got a lot of work to do,
We
Chair.
Got a lot of work to do, Chair. Yeah. Okay, so.
Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so those redeterminations, that means that every single Medicaid recipient in the state of Minnesota will have twice as many of those under HR 1.
Ms. Walls.
Thank you. Yes, that's correct.
So did HR 1 provide any funding for counties for doubling that administrative load?
Ms. Walls.
No.
No.
No. Okay.
No. And again, members, if you want to go after HR 1, there's stuff in there I don't like either. But I can't really say much because my endorsing convention is on Saturday.
And we wish you luck, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to, we're not in HHS, so I'm not trying to be like argumentative. I'm trying to understand because it occurs to me that like what we have here, because also the work requirements, are those also going to happen either in this, in MAXIS or METS? Yes.
Ms. Walls.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank
so,
you, Chair Gomez.
So that's another part of the increased administrative burden, right, that our counties are going to be facing, I believe, starting next year. And it occurs to me that this, because we have a system, because Medicaid is a system that is funded largely by the federal government, some match from the state, right? So that's where the funding comes from. And then the administration of it, in Minnesota at least, is put on the counties. And so what you have is like a disconnect between those two costs. The cost of actually funding the services that get to the people that provide the medical care, the substance use disorder treatment, et cetera, and then the administration. And so when you say, okay, twice as many eligibility checks per year for everybody, putting these work requirements on, it's like this huge cost going to the people who administer the system, and then you can book the savings on the balance sheet of the people who are funding the actual services to the actual people. But like I read this story about Medicaid work requirements in Georgia from the whatever it's like the GAO or whatever the federal budget office people. And they basically said, okay, so we put these work requirements in place, and in that case, they were looking at both the administration and the cost of the program together, and they didn't save any money. It was just that people got less health care and more administrative burden. And so, you know, so this is like, again, this is one of those things. It's like, they get to book the savings at the federal level, but really it's like the cost of it overall, if you look at providing care to people and administering the program, it's like the cost overall is not going to go down. It's just that we have to deal with it now instead of the feds. And so then I also just think about like the way that, you know, work requirements, you look at them, there are places around the country where they have them, increasing eligibility redeterminations. If you look at places where they, or like we can look at our own history of having more frequent eligibility checks and reducing them, and you can look at the costs of them, but it doesn't save us any money. It means people get less care. I think about the fact that I was surprised to see that half of the admissions for substance use disorder treatment in the state of Minnesota are funded by Medicaid. And so if we have like people falling off of Medicaid, which is what's going to happen when these changes are imposed, then I also think about the cost of that to counties and cities. What about, you know, if you have fewer people who are able to access substance use disorder treatment, what happens to your public safety budgets? Who pays for that? Substance use disorder is implicated in a lot of family separations in the child protection system. How are we, like, increasing costs there if we're cutting, you know, and kicking people off of their basic medical care? What's the cost, you know, of uncompensated care? Our Hennepin County commissioners are here. And I think about our safety net hospital, HCMC, which is right now facing, like, dire financial pressures that could close its doors before these changes even hit. And they're the safety net. And so it's like, you know, it's like we can look at our budgets in these little, like, silos, but if you look at the actual entire thing, it's like the cost doesn't go away. The cost of taking care of people who need care doesn't go away. It just gets shifted onto other places. It's like a balloon. It's like you can squeeze one part of the balloon, but the air doesn't go anywhere. It just goes into different places. And so we just really have to be clear-eyed about what we're doing to our counties. And I'm so appreciative of the chair for just for having this presentation today and all of our testifiers and everybody for being here. We put you all in impossible situations with some of the decisions that we make here and that other people make at other tables. And as you say, it's like, we get to decide, oh, we don't want to raise taxes. These guys don't get to say, we're not going to fill a pothole. We're not going to have anybody there when you call 911. We're not going to fund child protection. Like, that is a privilege that our local elected officials do not have. And so let's just be clear that when we get in our kind of little, like, ideological crouches about what we are and aren't going to fund, these guys don't have that ability to say, you know, we're just not going to do it. And so, again, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the conversation.
No, thank you, Chair Gomez, for those comments. Representative Anderson.
Very brief. Updating our IT systems, I mean, this is beyond pathetic. So it's like 15 years beyond pathetic, 20 years beyond pathetic. Okay. So
it was pathetic 15 years ago.
Yeah. Updating our IT systems at the state level and all the way down, you know, the things of county, that should be the number one thing we do. That will solve a ton of problems. Mm-hmm. It'll help solve a lot of the fraud problems. It'll help solve some of the administrative cost problems. It'll help with error rates. I mean, that should be what we focus on this session, bipartisan. So that's it.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Kozlowski.
Thanks, Chair. I'll just say that Chair Gomez, mic dropped. I'll let her have that.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Hewitt.
Real quick, and this is more of a question for staff. Why are we not, like, in the funeral situation, I know there's several others, why are we not allowed to have those be RFP'd out in the county so they can do a county-based purchasing on that? I mean, I'm sorry that's terrible to talk that way, but the truth is, they don't pay a lot for these, and a lot of times you can get them in the competitive space if you put them out for RFP. It's just, I've been talking to funeral directors, and they get real frustrated with this. So is there a law on the books that says they can't do this? I guess staff can answer that.
Who would like to handle that one? Swanson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hewitt, we're not sure, but we could take a look at that and get back to you.
Representative Hewitt?
Thank you, Chair Davis.
Okay, thank you. Now, that's the last member on my list. Are there any other members? If not,
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Robbins.
Very quickly, I just wanted to ask this because I've thought about this. We've had this conversation in the Fraud Committee. Minnesota is one of 10 states that has counties administer these programs. Would the counties prefer we do it like most of the other states?
Mr. Hilger.
Do we have the next few hours, Mr. Chair?
No, we don't.
then perhaps another hearing. That is a complex question. I think that our members are also asking themselves those questions as well. But I will tell you that it's not only a loaded question of what happens if we go either route. I think there are questions of where will there actually be true savings? Can the state, if we were to say tomorrow, great, the state takes back certain eligibility, would you save money there? counties would expect that we'd be able to save money, but are you ready to take on the hundreds of millions of dollars that it would cost in the state budget to take on all that workforce? I think the second question comes back to the clients we serve. And here again, we have some questions. Over certainly counties are really wanting to say, we do casework, we do the actual interactions with clients we think better than the state can do. The question on eligibility and applying on a SNAP application, I think that is a question that our folks still want to have a conversation about. But it merits, I think, a real serious conversation and frankly maybe even study about what this would look like. And even when you say the state take back eligibility, eligibility of what? There's 15, 20, 30 different programs, right? We'd have to say, are they right for all of those? Are they not? So a short answer that really does is a great question, but merits a much wider conversation. And hopefully that maybe that'll take place this year. But
Chair Robbins.
Thank you. I do hope we have an exploration of that question as a body.
And I know a few more questions have popped up, so excuse me, please talk
Mr.
to
Mr. Chair. We did bring gifts as well.
Yes,
well, under the $5 amount.
Is it under $5?
As you depart, we have DOS-based green screen buttons that say modernize now.
To me, it's worth more than $5. So
all right.
Okay, I'm going to go to Chair Gomez just a second, and I'm sorry, cut some folks off here at the end, but go talk to them. They're here. So if you got questions, go talk to the folks, any of the five up there. They're very good. Bills for Wednesday. I'm going to kind of leapfrog over Tuesday. House File 3816, Witte, Arnie, full expensing. House File 3817, Anderson P, bonus depreciation. House File 3815, was that R. Anderson? Okay. Representative Anderson P, business interest deduction changes. House File 3814, Patty Anderson, Representative Anderson, Section 179 expensing. So, and that could be subject to change. If we're seeing anything different, we will notify you immediately. Great. Chair Gomez.
Yeah, thanks. We're going to hear some property tax bills on Tuesday. So looking forward to it.
Awesome. Anything else for the good of the order? Hearing none, good government all the time. We're adjourned.